This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp. Zach is off filming the Green Berets for the next 2 weeks, and I am very happy to have a very well-known Trek FM alumni aboard. He is the host of Saturday Morning Trek, Trek FM's art director, and an associate producer for Standard Orbit, and good friend Aaron Harvey. Welcome aboard, Aaron.
Thank you. Good to see you. Is he really filming Green Berets? Is he really filming a film?
He is actually on a cruise.
He's on a cruise.
He's off to Alaska. He just couldn't get far enough away from me.
Well, maybe he's going to find Riker's roots. You know,
that could be it. He is on a journey, so to speak.
He's to the journey. No, never mind. That didn't work. Well, it's good to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I think this is the first time I've been on Standard Orbit. We were talking about that before. It's like I can't believe you've been on my show, and I thought that I had been on yours, but I have not.
And it all worked out. So it's a big deal having you aboard. It really is. It means a lot because we've been crossing paths and trying to communicate and come up with the right dates, and you know, things just seem to always get crazy. But in this case, on a Sunday, actually Mother's Day, here we are together.
Yes, my mom is having Chinese food for lunch. She's very excited because she has a day where she's not working, she's not doing anything with family and everything like that. So she's having her own Mother's Day by herself, and she's very happy about that.
Sometimes that's the greatest wish, right?
Yes. Just she sent her kids away, and she's like, "It's time to be alone."
Mm-hmm. I completely get it. My wife is out shopping. Perfect.
Nice.
We call that retail therapy.
Yeah.
So off she goes. So yeah, well, anyway, we hope all the moms out there have had a great day. This show will drop the day after Mother's Day, so how appropriate. And a couple of things to start off before we get into our topic today. I want to welcome Corey Elrod to the wonderful cast of Associate Producers. Thank you for the support of the show and your support of the network. It really means a lot to us.
You're collecting all of the Associate Producers. You're just grabbing them all.
Well, we've got seven.
That's
incredible.
Great.
Yeah, it is. You know, we're not the highest rated show, but I always claim we have the most passionate fan base or listener base. So it's very humbling.
Welcome aboard, Corey.
There we go, Corey. And then secondly, I had the pleasure this past week of seeking out and finding the creator of Trek FM. On a business trip this week to Japan, I had the good fortune of aligning schedules and actually meeting up with Christopher Brian Jones. So he is real. I know
he's not a hologram
wondered.
or a puppet, maybe? Like,
nope,
He's not really a short little guy behind the scenes.
No, and he's not like Bigfoot, where a lot of people have heard of him but never seen it. I have actually seen him. And it worked out well. I left last Sunday, and I sent a note to him because, you know, obviously Japan's a big place, and Tokyo is arguably the largest city in the world when you put in all its metro area. So I had no idea if we could make this work. And he told me his office was right next to Tokyo Tower. When I got to my hotel and I opened up the window, I was looking at Tokyo Tower. So we were able to meet up. We went to a nice a little IPA. He had a few beers, and we got to catch up. And it was a lot of fun meeting him in person. And quite a very interesting person. And obviously he's got a lot going on. But yes, I have touched the creator.
And moving on.
Okay. Well, that was a handshake.
Okay, okay.
I didn't think there's anything wrong with that. No. Anyway, so it was actually, it was a very
good... That's
pretty
cool. Yeah, yeah, we joked cool. for a long time. It's like, are we sure he's a real person? We've seen blurry images. And, and then, you know, you get like, it could be him. Maybe it's an actor that they've hired. You know, it's like...
Yeah, walking across a field. Is that him? No, anyway. Yes. Okay.
I sense a t-shirt coming on.
I do, too. I do, too. I think you could use the Patterson-Gimlin film as a... Go for it, Aaron.
In Search of Chris Jones. So, from what I understand this week, we're going to be talking about something like a movie that maybe you and I have a mild interest in.
The motion, semi-interest.
Yeah, like Star Trek The Motion Picture, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's actually correct. An understatement, yes. You and I are both huge connoisseurs of Star Trek The Motion Picture, and you can't see this because you're only listening to us, but I actually have concept art for V'ger on the wall. It's it sort of looks like a flying nacelle from the refit. It was the earlier versions before they brought in the second design company to work on the all the visuals.
Oh, so that's
was
neat.
The Yeah, so it was the Robert Abel, Richard Taylor drawn kind of V'ger nacelle sort of ship-looking thing. So I acquired that a few years ago. I'm very excited about that. So it was,
oh, that's awesome. I you know, it's funny because when you talk about the motion picture, it's a lot like John Denver. People go, what? It's like, yeah, either people really like it or they really hate it. There's nobody I know that just goes, yeah, it's okay. You know, it's kind of an extreme
John
film.
Denver, let's not talk about that.
See? You might be on the other side. See what I mean?
It was inflicted on me as a child.
See? That's exactly where I'm going. So, so it was a good analogy.
Except
that's
for the Muppets. It's okay when he was on the Muppet Christmas special.
Yes, he was okay on the Christmas special, and he could sing very well. But at any rate, I'm just saying that it is funny, the discussions.
It's like cilantro.
Have. There we go.
That's also another thing. It's like you either like it or you don't. There doesn't seem to be a middle ground.
Very well said. I guess there's plenty of analogies out there.
Yes.
But you know, it's funny. Because, so Zach leaves. I pull you on, and it's like, you know, we have talked. Zach's favorite movie is Star Trek III. And we've done three or four shows in and around Star Trek III, whether it's an origin story or the plot. And then he did the movies. And only one other time have I really been able to get in this. Now, there's nobody in our listener base that doesn't know I'm a big fan, and I think a lot of people realize you do. But that's the dangerous thing when you leave the keys to the car and you walk away. So, you know, Aaron, you know, as much as we can, and I do know there are some flaws in this movie, and we'll get to this. But what I'd really like to talk about is if I can work through my bias and you can do the same, I think we could have a very good discussion on this. What were the key elements, though, of this movie that made it work for you? What was it like the first time you saw it? What drew you in?
Okay, well, I saw it when it came out in theaters. I was 9 years old, 1979, and it, to me, I call this movie, and this is a weird kind of naming for them, but I call them flu movies, because I first saw 2001 A Space Odyssey when I had a high fever and was laying on the couch and I was sick. Okay. I was like, this is the longest movie about nothing that is so amazing. You know, I was a kid. I didn't really get all the nuances that Arthur C. Clarke was going for and Kubrick at the same time. And it was a movie that was like, it's been on for 28 hours. It has to have been. You know, it's time dilates when you watch it. It's really interesting. But for me, it's not a negative thing. You know, people like call it the motionless picture and all these other derogatory terms. And I really like it. It basically is a Hollywood art film. You don't get a lot of those. Tron was one of those, to a lesser degree, The Black Hole. You know, it's just these films that it isn't necessarily 100% the plot that has to drive it. So for me, I think that was really interesting. And what I really liked about it is I had a sense of scale for the first time of the Enterprise and of the universe. It didn't feel like I was on a set, you know, with seven people who would show up occasionally on the bridge, and then they'd stop by a cardboard planet. You know, I'm not saying that the effects were like ruin the stories or anything like that, but there is that overall feeling of like, okay, you know, kind of like the joke about Voyager. One time on Mystery Science Theater, it's like Mike was pretending to be Janeway, and he's like, I'm responsible for the lives of 200 people on the ship, 198 that we never see. You know, it's sort of like, so it was that feeling. I'm like, oh, great. This universe is fleshed out. We see Earth for the first time. Mm-hmm. That was amazing. The year after, so it was 1980, went to San Francisco for the first time. And I'm just like, I had to go over the Starfleet Bridge. You know,
sure.
I understood it was the Golden Gate Bridge, but in my mind, it was like it had transposed into this really cool bridge that had a monorail that went across and, you know, ended up on the other side with Starfleet Academy, or at least Starfleet headquarters. So there was just the visual aspect, as, you know, as a budding graphic designer at age 9, I guess, you know, there was that. And it was just, it felt very NASA. I know that sounds weird, but it's like, okay, I can see this as a futuristic spaceship. I buy this a lot more than I used to. And then when it went to Star Trek II, I'm like, why is this suddenly a military submarine? What happened? You know, it felt like if you went from Star Trek the motion picture into Star Trek the Next Generation, that is a logical visual transition.
Right.
And you could have put Star Trek 2, 3 and all, you know, before, and that would have all, like, okay, I can see the bridge, it changed from that into the second one, and then it went to this super clean one, and then it went to the Next Generation with these touch panels and everything. But it doesn't make any sense to me the way it, like, suddenly regressed in uniforms and design and everything between the motion picture and Next Generation. So I think there were a lot of these elements that worked just as sort of like, it was science fiction in its purest form. The design was really cool. And, you know, it was great, obviously, to see the people that you saw on television back on the big screen doing what they had done before. And it really, when you think about it, wasn't that long compared to how much we've waited for Star Trek on television again. So
yeah, that's true. That's true. So, you know, it's funny you say that, because every point you made was spot on. I was a little older than you. I hate to admit that.
Hey, but I'm normally the oldest one on a podcast, so, you know.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
I enjoy being the kid now.
Well, enjoy it, Sonny. So, yeah, I was a whole 4 years older than you.
I was
13. Yeah. I didn't drive to go see it. But anyway, I had seen Star Trek, but I wasn't pulled into it. I wasn't a big fan. There was nobody in my family that was watching it, I guess, consistently, although I had seen it. And I thought the movie was exactly what you said. It was just tremendous. The size, the scale, the functionality, everything seemed so real. And the music was phenomenal. I still feel that is probably the best score for a movie. Even though I know I'm a big Star Trek fan and I have some biases here, it is a phenomenal score. And it's been used so much, I know it's been kind of dilutive. But if you saw it like we did, you know, in the theaters and the way it starts off, I mean, it's
what is that called? That piece of music that plays before the, not intermission, but the...
You had the Ilias theme playing before it started, but...
Yeah, what is that? Well, basically, it was there just was a theme playing before the movie. So you were actually getting music before it even started, which was great. So it really set the mood before the curtains closed and then opened up again and...
Yeah. I you know, it's funny. I don't know what that term was, but I do remember just a star field and that beautiful music, and it was very, very soothing. And then boom, you know, it just like Goldsmith's theme does, it just jumps right out at you and pulls you right in. And a couple of the other things that I thought made this such a good movie. I mean, we were coming off a lot of science fiction in 1979, and yes, you had Star Wars. That was one thing. You also had Battlestar Galactica on TV. You also had Buck Rogers and
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, which was phenomenal. I'll give it that. But, you know, I'm just saying you kind of went from really big scale to everything in between, and you just went, oh. And Star Trek the Motion Picture, I think there was an element that a lot of people felt that, oh, okay, because now we know there was a lot more going on in the background with Phase 2 and stuff. But at the time, Oh, okay, so Paramount's jumping on with their franchise. And I just thought they hit it out of the park. And I know a lot of people who saw it just didn't like it. But I think we saw it through a very different lens than they did. We looked at not only the beautiful music and the effects and seeing old friends that we hadn't seen in a long time, but the ship was so darn functional. It was, mm-hmm. it still is, the only yeah. movie, the only movie where everything has a purpose, a point, and the people that are operating it have assigned responsibilities, and it's just so structured. And, you know, when you're making a movie, a lot of people, like, they don't care about those details. They just want to tell the story, you know, and move it along. And it doesn't matter if Schmedlaff's standing at this station and then he's over here or whatever. In this case, you know, from the second they arrive or Kirk shows up, it's like there's a chain of command, there's an order to things, there's a functionality to things. It was probably more military in some aspects, but it didn't have that feel, like you said, when they shifted to Star Trek II. But it mm-hmm. just had this feel of, I don't know, it just seemed very authentic, which when you go from the TV show to the motion picture, that's a hell of a swing.
Yeah. It's almost like the them getting back together and having, you know, Shatner as Kirk sort of kind of transpose between real world and into the fictional world. Like, okay, there's the captain again. There's a, you know, it's just that it's like, oh, we're all getting back together again. It's all falling into place. And there's sort of this willingness to like, okay, good. Decker's being moved aside. We're now back comfortable with this person, and everybody wants to do their job and they want to be, make everyone proud of them. And I'm not being able to kind of put that into one coherent sentence, but it's just, it was a very authentic sort of reaction, it felt like.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny now because as time has gone on and you and I and so many of the listeners have read all the stories that gone on pre-production, post-production, the you know, how are we going to make this ending or whatnot? And, you know, go ahead.
No, I say they had agreed to a launch date, basically. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the reverse of what's happening with Discovery. It was sort of like, we have December 7th.
Right.
And it has to be made. And because if not, then we lose all this money to these theaters. So no matter what, something was going out December 7th. And when it turned out that, you know, there were so many issues and stuff, they just got it done. Where Discovery is sort of like, well, we want to do the best we can. So January, May, whenever, you know, it's sort of
right.
Like, and it's interesting to see the two sides of that. And I think once it's going to have a very similar kind of background story that mm-hmm. the motion picture did. That was stuff that we didn't know at the time. We didn't have social media. We didn't have a lot of, you know, pop culture itself wasn't such a big thing to have regular people follow. You wouldn't have people who like cared how much money the movie made, who was just an average everyday person. Now you've got people talking about that all the time. So
that is, yeah, that's how they're, that's, you're right. I don't think financials was what defined a successful movie
yeah.
when we were going to the movies. You're right. And today that is it.
Yeah.
Right.
So another, I think it's there's that aspect to it too, which is really kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, it's an interesting launch date too. I know it's Pearl yeah. Harbor, it's all those other mm-hmm. things, but it was interesting to launch in the winter time, and it was in theaters for quite a while, and it actually made a lot of money, even though it was, you know, wildly, you know, I would say, I forget what the score was, but I think it was sub 50 or right around the 50s in Rotten Tomatoes. If you look today, it wasn't quite as high, but it opened the door to Star Trek for me. So that's why I probably have a lot of appreciation for it, because it pulled me in, you know, then I started watching the shows and staying more focused. And
well, it couldn't have been too horrible since there was several films after and many television shows. So it didn't kill the franchise. That's for sure.
It didn't kill it at all, and there was a lot of things that came from it, especially, you know, I think the Enterprise itself, one of the things that, you know, there's a lot of talk about Gene Roddenberry and the way, you know, he manages things and whatever, and Lord knows there was a lot of ruckus making this movie, just like there was a lot of ruckus when he was making The Next Generation. However, his ability to ensure that the ship was designed a certain way, that it had this kind of gravitas in you know, the same pride that we feel when we see it, because if we're watching the best team in Starfleet or the best team in Star Trek, then it has to have the best vessel, and it has to be something that's, you know, kicking ass and taking names. And that's what we got in the motion picture. And it quickly got dismissed after that, I thought. But I see the same thing in TNG. A lot of people have questions about the design of the D or whatever. Mm-hmm. Even I do. However, as soon as they said it was the flagship of the Federation, I said, I can get into this.
Yeah.
Because this is the way it should be.
Yeah.
And I think that's how the Enterprise appeared. And, of course, the Enterprise is arguably my favorite character. So there it is.
Well, and what this is just a kind of little side note, but I think it's funny mm-hmm. that people later, you know, it's like, you know, the Enterprise should have had seatbelts and blah, blah, blah. Like, if you've seen the motion picture, they have little restraints that move over and actually stop them from flying out of their chairs. That's what the director was just like, you know what? This makes sense. We should put this in. And, you know, and the headrest moved to, like, to protect the head from getting, you know, bounced around and stuff. So I think it's interesting that that appeared and then disappeared.
But, you know, it's funny, Aaron, the attention to detail in this film is what I'm getting at. And I think that's probably it helped it and it hurt it, because, you know, whether it's the light flashing on just before the shuttle pod docks, mm-hmm. you know, all these little intricate things that they did to try to make it as real as possible. And they focused on that.
All
and
the I guess, signage, you know, that Rick Sternbach created, there's a whole book that has just the transporter logo and the bathroom logo and, you know, just everything that's like exists that you don't even see necessarily.
Right, but they just went to that level of saying this, we're going to make this as real as possible. And I think there's an appreciation from my point of view and yours too, I'm seeing it, where you're just like, wow, they really focused on that. And then there's other people say, yeah, but it would have been nice if there was a little bit more action, a little bit faster pace, a little bit more plot. And I do get that. I really do. But there's so much to appreciate when you see that level of work. And now, you know, it's a little bit different because you can literally program those things. You don't even have to build them. But they took the time to do that.
It's sort of along, you know, in that era of films like Blade Runner, motion picture, Tron in some ways. You know, there's just, it's that kind of, that last bit of real filmmaking before it, you know, kind of just transitioned to summer blockbuster slash, you know, then in the 90s when Jurassic Park came along, it was like, oh, everything can be done with CGI now. And then it just sort of from there, I'm not saying that movies aren't crafted well now, but they're just, it's different. It's a different type of filmmaking.
Yeah.
We just don't see anymore.
Well, it even changed, right? From Star Trek, the motion picture. And I understand Star Trek II. You know, and I know this is Norm's favorite movie, so I'm not trashing it. I do love the movie, but they just went in a complete, you know, they focused on a different look.
Yep.
I think they tried to make it somewhat realistic, but they you know, the color scheme,
no smoking sign and stuff like that. I'm just like, really?
Was yeah, and a regular exit sign. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I'm gonna.
I see, but it's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point. And that's what I mean. They
the story
did
is great,
things.
But those things, like, that's what – it's funny because I feel like some people are like, okay, I'm bogged down by the fact that there's so many details in motion picture. I'm the reverse. Like, if one of those details jump out, your story can be amazing, and I'm still going to be like, why is there a 20th century exit sign on your – like, that makes zero sense. You know, it's just like – especially when we've never seen that before, and then we never see it again. You know, it's just, and no, they're not smoking at that point. They're not idiots. They know that smoking is not a good thing, and that you don't ever see any Starfleet officer smoking. I don't think. Maybe we did.
No,
but not. That's not in a holodeck or a part of a, you know, time travel adventure character. So, but it's one of those things that was just like, I can see how people are polarized by certain things, and it's like that's one of those things that just pull me out of a story. I'm like, okay, amazing, but yeah, that song didn't exist at that time period or something like that. You know, it's just those little details that makes me a geek, I guess. That's just sort of like,
well, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in two very different, you know, you're a graphic designer and you live in that world. You're a creative person, and I'm the opposite, right? I'm not very creative. I'm very kind of logical, business-minded numbers, you know, hitting, you know, it's just two very different people, but we both saw the exact same things, which I think is really cool because it's like, okay, you know, it's not just the military guy, right, who's paying attention to the fact that they're very cognizant of who's doing what level they're in. Anyway, all I was saying was that, you know, that between two of us, two very different backgrounds, but still seeing the same thing. And me being, you know, very military guy where rank is important and they had the structure down and they had it to the gnat's ass detailed. And it was something I could really relate to. You saw the same thing and you're more of the, wow, that is incredible attention to detail. They put this in, they put this point and the structure. And that's what I think made it so real.
Yeah.
And I had a hard time going from the motion picture to the beloved Wrath of Khan because of those things. I came around, but the first time I saw the movie, I walked out of it, The Wrath of Khan, going, I guess it was okay. You know, and after I saw it a few more times, I really fell in love with it, but it just, because it wasn't the scale, it wasn't the, it wasn't, you know, a large scale Hollywood movie. It was a TV, you know, episode of the week or a 2-hour TV special that they amped up a little bit.
That's interesting because when I remember that I saw it in the same theater that I saw the motion picture in, and I was thinking to myself, like, is it because I was younger when I saw this movie the first time that the whole scale of everything seems smaller? And I'm realizing that it was probably more of the way it was shot and the way it was put together. It just wasn't as expansive and epic. In fact, I think even the proportion or the size of the film that it was shot on might have actually been different. Mike Schindler could answer that. And is probably yelling at his podcast, his iPhone or whatever he listens to on right now. For me, it was weird because like Star Trek II, I know I saw it in a theater, but it had no impact on me whatsoever. It was just sort of like, oh, okay. And then Star Trek III was big because at that point I was reading Starlog magazine. Mm-hmm. And as we had talked about before we started recording, that Gene Roddenberry had leaked that, you know, Spock was going to die because that was something he wasn't, you know, fond of. Right. And so when people are in the theater weeping, and I literally was in a theater where somebody was crying, I'm just like, dude, it was like, you know, I thought it was because Leonard Nimoy just didn't want to do this anymore. And it's like, he's just an actor, doesn't want to do, you know, even as a kid, I was still thinking more, I guess, of the background and the mechanics of the film. I'm sure I was real fun to go to see movies with as a kid, because I was the one who was into it like people are now, and people didn't enjoy going to films where they had to hear everything that was how it was put together and who did what. And it didn't make the huge impact on me that it seemed to make on a lot of other people. I remember the bug in the ear. Mm-hmm. Like, ew, that was gross. Star Trek III really made more of an impact after that because it was, you know, using computer graphics for the whole Genesis effect. And, or is that in 2?
That was in 2 and 3.
That was in 2 and 3. I guess that's true.
But 2, you're right. Star Trek II was the first time that was the first CGI,
yeah,
I think, in history, right?
Yeah. Well, no, but.
For a movie, I thought. Anyway.
West Wing, great. Westworld, the images that were on Yul Brynner's vision, that was actually done with a computer.
Okay.
Doesn't mean it was good, but it was done with a computer. It looks like it could have been done with something else. But the motion picture still, like, even when I was older, had stuck with me a lot more than the other two films. Even though I think I knew the other two films better, obviously there's also more dialogue in the other two for the things you'd remember. It's like, The motion picture, and you know, it makes sense that the person who worked on 2001 A Space Odyssey also worked on that. There's a lot of, you know, just the cinematography is similar. Then you have, you know, and you do have like long periods of like no dialogue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and that's what I would say is probably one of its bigger flaws is that, you know, you take a Star Trek II, which has a lot of dialogue. It's about the characters. It's about Kirk. It's about Spock. It's about their relationship. It's all this. This is about really a space adventure. It's about the ship. It's there's the subplot there of Kirk and his obsession and all that stuff. But it wasn't anything that was played out. It wasn't masterfully done. It was well done. And those, I guess, would be the gaps in the movie. And that's where a lot of people just go, yeah, the plot. And it's like, yeah, you could cut that movie down and, you know, you could get there a lot sooner. And,
right.
And it was just, yeah, it was a visual feast. It wasn't the most, like you said, Tarantino probably was going crazy watching this movie. Right?
We don't have people running around quoting things from motion picture, really. I mean,
you know what I would quote as a kid, just being a geek, would be things like viewer off, and I'd shut the TV off.
Yeah.
Silly things like that. The mechanical aspects of this movie. Nothing like Screaming Khan, which has become the,
right.
You know, a big piece of pop culture. You're absolutely right. There's nothing that comes out of the motion picture that has become a piece of pop culture. You know.
What's interesting, well, except for, yeah, the transporter, the people dying.
Yeah, you know, that's okay.
Bits and pieces of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I did like that there are scenes that I remember when I was younger, because, I mean, I was 9 when I saw this, so it's like, yeah, I enjoyed it, but I'm still, like, got a lot more out of it as an adult. The scenes where you're like, why isn't Spock talking, and why aren't they talking to Spock, and why, it was just weird, you know. And then as an adult, I'm like, it's handled really well. He's gone through the Kolinar. He's not really himself, or the self that they knew him as. And it's just incredibly awkward, and it's played really well, and to the point where he's just like, sit down, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, like, you know, and that's incredibly funny, actually, when you, like, so I think there are, had there been a little bit more meat or something before that, the rest of that could have played out a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, yeah. You know, if we're going to talk about, you know, things that could be improved, because I'm not saying this is a perfect movie by any means.
No way.
It could stand to be edited or reshuffled or something. There's something that it's like, and no, I'm never going to suggest that they cut the dry dock scene, though. I'm sorry. The Enterprise is a character, and it finally got its, you know, 15 minutes of fame, basically. Like, I love the flying around. Mm-hmm. That, if you shorten that, you lose the impact of it.
Oh, absolutely. But
there are other things like inside a V'ger or whatever, like maybe with a better model or a better lit model, you could get a little bit of better sense of scale, and some of that could be reduced a bit. And now we could do the there's a scene that was cut, the memory wall, where I think, I'm trying to remember exactly how they phrased it, but basically you see Spock is flying by in a spacesuit about, like, with all these pictures of, I think it's V'ger's memory, basically. That could be done today, and that would have been really interesting, and you still could have kept that sort of no dialogue visual feast, but still got more story across that way.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, the flying through the clouds, the overflight of V'ger, yeah, that could have been 5 minutes.
Until I was older, I also knew what V'ger really looked like. There wasn't until, like, the television movie when you see a screen that has, like, an outline. I'm like, oh, that's what it looks like. Okay. Because
yeah.
It's a cloud, basically, and you fly into it, and suddenly Voyager's inside of it. And you're like, okay, I still have no idea what this looks like.
So. No, I think the director's cut is a pretty good version. That's they did whittle that down a bit, and
yes.
You could see the ship finally. And they even edited it, because in the motion picture, they say it's 82 AUs,
oh, yeah.
Right? So yeah. 82 astronomical units, and astronomical units, what, 93 million miles?
Mm-hmm.
And like 82 of them? Okay. That's massive. And then in the director's cut, they'd go 2 astronomical units.
Well, and it's interesting, because I had the National Geographic Our Universe book growing up as a kid. That was like,
okay.
And it's still sitting on the bookshelf in my, you know, bedroom next to, it's like always there. And it's got beautiful illustrations. I think there might actually be a Rick Sternbach illustration in there, which is kind of funny. But it had, that's when I was learning what an astronomical unit was. I'm like, 82? That doesn't sound right. And it just, even as like a 10-year-old or 9-year-old or 10-year-old, it's like, this is weird. And so I'm glad that they edited that. You could tell that they just chopped out the eight part.
Yeah. But now you understand why it took so damn long to get through that cloud.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, if you leave it at 82, it just makes a lot more sense.
It does, yeah. Yeah, and you wonder how many people...
It's coming to the solar system. It doesn't really even have to come into the solar system. It's just outside of it, and it's still inside of it.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, this is, we saw the new Klingons for the first time.
We did. you know, the other thing is too, not only did you see the new Klingons, which I really liked, and obviously it took off.
Yeah.
The ships look great. But even today, you know, and I've had this conversation with Zach a few times, the effects in the whole story for Star Trek The Motion Picture, I think it holds up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really holds up because they made it was obviously very expensive to do. It was painstakingly detailed. You know, you even watching the reboots, which have some incredible special effects, it still doesn't feel as real or authentic to me. I don't know what it is. Maybe because it's tangible. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't. There's something, you know, obviously it's not a model what they use today.
Right.
It's a computer. I mean, some of it is. They did a much better job, I think, in Beyond of using physical sets. So that was nice to get some of the feeling of that. But the exteriors and everything still are done with computers. And no matter what you do to make it look fantastic, there's still something that's just like, I don't know if it's your brain telling you. Like, I don't know. If you took 9-year-old me from 1979 and showed it to me, would I go, there's something not right about that? It's like, it doesn't look quite real. Or would I be like, wow, that's the most amazing model I've ever seen. You know, I don't know because I've been in this timeline all the way through to today. So I still have that sort of like, well, I know how it's done. I know what it is. Well, that lighting's really interesting. They did a pretty good job with, you know, how the different textures are getting stuff bounced off it or something like that. But there's something about a model that your brain just goes, okay, I know this is a physical thing, and yet my brain is being tricked into thinking it's much bigger than it is. So it feels real. Like you might be able to take a picture of a spaceship that is sized exactly the same as the Enterprise and then create a computer model and not be able to tell the difference. But still, if somebody told you one was real and one was not, your brain would just be tricked into liking one better than the other. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, plus, you know, the motion picture was the only one. You know, I was talking to Paul Olson, who painted the Enterprise.
Yes.
No, he's a character. He really is. But
he did the pearlescent cover
for the pearlescent piece and the Aztec-ing, you know, of it, and you know, and again, painstaking detail, and they filmed it against a black screen so that when they lit it up, and that's a whole nother thing that they did with dentist lights and all that stuff. I mean, painstakingly gorgeous what they did with the ship, and some of the pictures from the stills of the ship are just amazing, you know, with kind of a blue reflective piece to it. And then after that, when ILM took over, you know, they just painted it straight white. And, you know, after painting it just white against a green screen, because they couldn't film it the same way it was done in the motion picture. It was too expensive, or there's just a different process. It never looked the same. And and that's a piece of it, too. And it's like that's what gave it its... I guess it's that incredible, and I know a lot of the same shots are used in Star Trek II that were used in the motion picture as well. And you can see the difference very clearly from what ILM did and what the team did with the motion picture.
They just never captured it. The car that was brand new, and then, you know, it had the wax job, and then just after a while the wax just got dull, and it wasn't, every time you took it to the car wash, it still just wasn't quite as good as it was originally.
Yeah.
It has that sort of feel to it a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, and it was, I you know, one of the things, you know, it was 3 years after the motion picture was made that Star Trek II came out. And yet, you know, many, many more years were supposed to have passed in between.
Yeah.
And, and that was part of the, I guess, part of the problem for me was, although it was great for the plot of the Wrath of Khan, it was like, now it's, you know, the ship isn't as big a deal anymore. You know, it's now it's it's a training ship or whatever it's supposed to be.
Right. So
it was just interesting, you know, that way. It was kind of deflating a little bit.
it was funny because when I worked in Marina Del Rey in the 90s, and I realized just last year that I used to walk by the place where the ship was assembled and put together in some of the early shots, I guess. Like, it was down the street, and I walked by it every day going to work, and it was, like, at that point, a small design agency or something that was in that building, and a Pilates class or one of those, you know.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, and then I looked at it, I'm like, I know that address. And I like typed it into Google Maps, and I was just like, oh my gosh, that was literally down the street. Like, so had I lived there in the 70s, I would have seen that the ship being moved into the some of those you see like the big warehouse shots, and they're kind of moving the thing around. Mm-hmm. That was where it was. So kind of interesting. It's cool to be in LA when you come across those sort of things.
Well, it's cool. You know, before we started recording, and you were just talking about all these people that you know and that are in the industry. You know, it just
they're
just
here. That's why it's not. It's they're here. Yeah,
yeah, they're there. But you actually know them. You're interacting. You know, writers and things. It's like, wow. Yeah. It's a Doug Drexler. You know, oh, I was talking to Doug. It's like, oh, really? Oh, okay. Good for you, Aaron. Yeah, I've heard of him. I've seen him on TV.
Facebook is the real equalizer, because I think these people it would be much harder to get an introduction to if you hadn't. I mean, yes, a couple people I did meet in real life that sort of that kind of pushed me into that world, but being able to message somebody and have them talk back to you and then create a conversation back and forth, you know, for all of the horrible things that social media seems to be responsible for, that's kind of amazing. Like, I can't imagine, you know, being a fan of the motion picture in 1979 and having the access to the kind of people that we have for, like, say, Discovery. Mm-hmm. Like, we still, you know, people can tweet these people and sometimes they respond if they, you know, it's a neat equalizer. I think that's, you know, that's my little tangent for social media, but
well, that's one thing we do well on Standard Orbit. We do tangents. Yes. And that's just kind of where we go. So let's shift back a little bit. So when you watched the director's cut, did you feel that they had captured most of the gaps that they had? After watching that, what do you feel they captured well and what still could have been improved a bit?
Well, the big gap that they captured that I almost don't want to call out, because when it was called out to me, that's all I saw, is when the Enterprise is leaving space dock. Mm-hmm. If you look to the left bottom of the ship where the engineering hull is,
yep,
there is a post that is stuck into the ship, and it's basically, it's pulled on like a dolly kind of thing, and it's slowly pulled out of space dock. The problem is that post crosses the girders of space dock at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So when you see that, all you see is a model on a stick being drug out. And I think it must have been like 1994 when somebody pointed that out, and I was just like, I don't like you anymore. I cannot. It's like, for all of these years, I never saw that, and now that's all I see. But they did fix that in the director's cut. Unfortunately, and this is, you know, people have had this, like, why don't we have this on Blu-ray? The effects and everything that was done were not done in a Blu-ray resolution, and those computer files don't exist anymore. So everything would have to basically be recreated.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Do imagine there are people who are in the industry that would probably volunteer their time or something to, you know. Yeah. I don't think you legally can do that because of union rules and all that, but it would be really something if down the road that if everything, you know, works out, that eventually they'll be able to do that. I think that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, some of the things that they did well, I thought the opening scene with Spock on Vulcan, mm-hmm, looked a lot cleaner. They had a little CGI. They
got
Spock
rid of the moon.
They got rid of the moon, but they gave it scale. And that was probably the only time in the motion picture where I was like, yeah, that's a set. And then everything else felt very, you know, very
you
tangible
the weird,
and
like
real.
Crystalline legs of the Vulcan, whatever they were, mm-hmm, the gods.
Yeah, so I thought they did a nice job there. I think they, you know, they obviously they show you V'ger, they show it, mm-hmm, right outside Earth, and it's something that now it's like, okay, now with the cloud gone, it's still a big ship, but it's not crazy. And
they also fixed like the windows, all the things that you see outside the ship, which is like it's black, or the reverse view from the officer's lounge, mm-hmm, that's supposed to have the two, you know, pylons. And I think when it certain scenes when it would tilt, they, mm-hmm, just didn't have it, so then they would composite in. The you could see the nacelle in the background or whatever. So it's like the views out the window actually reflected what was out there.
Yeah, they took a detailed move and they added a lot more detail, which was pretty cool. And, you know, it just seemed to have a little bit more of a pacing to it, just because they did cut down some of those those long journeys, and they were still fairly long, but just not as bad, I thought. And you know, and I think that Robert Wise had said when they redid the cut, if he had had more time, it would have been trimmed down. And a lot the studio spent so much money on the effects, they were like, show them what we paid for. Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean, this is supposed to be eye candy. This is supposed to be, you know, the
too much candy gives you a stomachache sometimes.
It does, yeah. And that's where they went overboard. So yeah. So I say, is it a perfect movie? No. Is it a good movie? I think so. And does it reflect the way I would have loved to have seen Star Trek go forward a little bit? You know, Admiral Kirk's uniform still the best uniform.
Yes. Interesting. There's two related to that. Uniforms, I think it was interesting. Robert Wise said one of the reasons he switched to those uniforms is because he felt the original series made them look like they were wearing pajamas, which is interesting because that is the criticism everybody has of the uniform from the motion picture, except for maybe the Admiral's uniform, that they look like pajamas. So we have wildly different ideas of what pajamas are, apparently, Robert Wise and the rest of the world.
Right.
And the other thing you were saying, you know, that it would be, this is sort of like, would you like to have Star Trek have followed forward a little bit more like this? I kind of feel like the motion picture might have been the movie that we would have got if we still had Captain Pike. If we had stuck with, who's the actor's name? My gosh, my brain is just fried. It's Sunday.
Jeffrey Hunter?
Jeffrey Hunter, yes. Yep. If Jeffrey Hunter, you know, obviously, unfortunately, he passed away early in life. But if he had continued to be the captain, and I kind of felt like we would have had more like Picard Kirk in that time period if we had continued with him. And I feel like the motion picture is actually kind of a Captain Pike sort of film.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think you made a great analogy at the beginning where you said it. If you take the motion picture and you go right into Star Trek: The Next Generation, you went 80 years from that. It seems to fit very tightly. Mm-hmm. You know, the uniforms seem to be more aligned. You know, people don't like them either. You know, the ship is the big deal. The captain is more cerebral, thinking things through. Kirk was more like that. I mean, a little bit more action-oriented. You know, he'll always be a little bit more action-oriented. But that you're absolutely right. And, you could see it was evolving into that direction. So, yeah, you could tie it to.
They went from, like, having the wrist communicators. You know, if you went from wrist to the button, you know, it would be like the flipping, the wrist, and then here. It's like that is a logical progression. Mm-hmm. And then the wrist communicators disappeared.
They
were in one movie and
back to flip phones. Yeah, yeah. Just to get that nostalgic feel, which you know, in the thing that they used in The Wrath of Khan was as bigger as a 1980s wireless phone. I
mean, it got huge. I don't maybe it's better range. I mean, it's a ruggedized, more military version or something. Like I can kind of see that, but yeah, there was that. And if you look in sick bay and in Kirk's quarters, their wall screens were also huge compared to the screens that you eventually see later. Like they actually are larger, I think, than possibly some of the TNG screens. So it just feels like it was more futuristic than a lot of the other movies in many ways.
Isn't that funny? So the technology in the late 70s, it wasn't anywhere near where it was when they finished up making the original films in 1990, 1991. Mm-hmm. But yet, I still didn't see anything that matched the background or even the examination table. I mean, again, just incredible detail with that shadow flying over and you could see it being scanned and the way it's being reflected. It was like, man, that's pretty cool. And they had to do that. I wouldn't even know how they do it, Aaron, because today I could see how they could do it because it's a program or somebody's designing it. I don't even know how they pulled that together.
I don't know if I know off the top of my head. Eventually, when Saturday Morning Trek transitions from the animated series into the later 70s, we're going to end with the motion picture. By then, I'm sure I'll be able to tell you how to reconstruct it in your basement.
That would be fun.
We will probably have way too much information in our heads about the show. But there's just so many things. And the big... rec room or not? Was it the rec room or is it just officers? Yeah,
that was
just
rec room.
And you could see and that was another thing that I think they added in the director's version is that back wall actually is the rim of the saucer. So I was very recently that I was like, where is this thing actually? Mm-hmm. And I went, it's like, oh, if you look at the backside of the ship, it is on the port side. No, sorry, starboard side. So on the right, if you're looking from the back, mm-hmm. To the kind of like a fourth of the way between the impulse engines and the middle part of the saucer. I'm just like, oh, that's really cool. And then I don't think I ever noticed that like the windows there were different layout than the windows on the other side. So, and that would have been a really interesting, like if you're going to do a director's cut, or if you wanted to like add it, like maybe go into the rec room from the outside, because that would really give you a scale at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be pretty cool. Yeah. That's, I didn't know that's where it was located. I, for some reason, I thought it was kind of somewhere in center middle of the saucer section, but.
So no, I'll post a picture in the Babel conference for the listeners to check out.
Okay, so what are your final thoughts on Star Trek the Motion Picture?
Yeah, I didn't like it. No.
Okay, that's all the time we have.
Yeah, right. No, it's, you know, obviously it has flaws. It's not necessarily the movie I pick up if I want to like, okay, what's something I want to listen to that has a story or something that's, you know, it, because I'm not going to get necessarily anything in the vein of the motion picture, or sorry, in the vein of, you know, Star Trek IV or even First Contact or something like that. You don't get the, mm-hmm. like the cool little, you know, fun story elements or the character moments necessarily. But when I want to be inspired about humanity, about movie making, about Star Trek in general, it's like, I will put that in and just absorb it. I can't say enough good things about it, and I'm really happy that that sort of maligned sort of reaction that fans who have it is sort of reversing. I've noticed this in the last probably 3 to 5 years that there are a lot more people talking about it in a positive light than there used to be.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how those
rediscovered.
I believe that's correct. Yeah, things when people go back and they explore, I think that I've heard that on different podcasts. You know, we're also dealing with a lot of people that, you know, grew up with TNG in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the movie elements, they are kind of rediscovering and having fun with. And it's like they just kind of progressively go back. And you hear the same thing. Oh, I saw the motion. It was boring. You know, that. But then they go back and they can kind of see the, I think what you pointed out well, the continuity between mm-hmm. the two franchises. And you're right, it's kind of come full circle, I guess. More appreciated, like a 2001, which is what they were going for. It's funny. I pop that in when I really just feel like I need to escape. And that's my like go-to film for that. It's if things are just crazy or whatever and I just need to get my mind off things, that's what I'll put on, because I can really get enveloped into this movie. I don't know why it pulls me in still to this day, it does. The other ones, you know, they're fun rides. They're great movies. There isn't a Star Trek movie I won't watch. There are some that are difficult to watch, but I'll still watch them. Yeah. You know, that type of thing. But that's you know, that's kind of where I go constantly. Even, you know, well, I'm as old as Star Trek, being 50, so it's still there. You know.
Yeah, I'm 47 this year, so I'm having my Star Trek themed party. Not that I need an excuse for that, but you know, since 47 is the number that pops up everywhere in Star Trek, or modern Star Trek at least. So
I'm assuming Larry Nemechek will be there.
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
well, I'll post pictures, and we're doing a sort of a tiki Risa / Neelix holodeck program. Sort of kind of theme, so we're gonna have like Hawaiian style food and stuff like that, and
wow, very
out
nice.
In the backyard, just very casual. So that's
okay. Well,
so if you're in the LA area, wait, no, I shouldn't do that.
No, don't do that. Just quickly say, hey, if you're in Hawaii,
yeah, exactly. If you're on Risa, stop in. Yeah. Oh, and when one last point about sure. kind of people rediscovering the motion picture, I've noticed that people who are younger are actually liking it more than the people who are rediscovering it that are more our age. There is something about like people have just had that embedded in their head for so long that it's like, oh, this is, you know, it's slow, it's boring, I don't want to see it. That they, it's almost like, oh, I've really never seen the motion picture, but I've seen, you know, Star Trek Beyond or what, and they'll go back and like, oh, this is really interesting. So, you know, like my co-host on Saturday Morning Trek, Adam Drozin, it's like, he loves that picture, or that, I'm sorry, he loves that movie. And my first reaction was like, really? You know, because I was like, I always thought in my head that, you know, younger people would be like, oh, this is, but it's not. I've found exactly the opposite.
Wow, that's surprising to me. One, I didn't know that. And two, you know, maybe it's being as old as I am and the way I look at things, you know, if it isn't just overwhelming with, you know, like a Marvel movie or something along those lines where your head is spinning with the level of effects and things like that they put in it, you know. I watched Doctor Strange, fine movie, but man, I needed an aspirin, right? And that's what I'm thinking. People need that constant movement, constant, you know.
Maybe that's why they like it. It's refreshing. It's different.
Yeah, it slows things down, and you can take a few minutes to appreciate what's around.
Even the people who worked on Beyond are like, could we slow down and look at our work for 4 seconds? You know, it's just like there was a lot of, you know, because when the people don't hate 2001, they might, you know, some people find that slow as well. But I think it's a really... it's a good analog that they're very similar in that way. So,
well, the big difference between I think the motion picture and 2001 is motion picture ends and you know exactly what happened.
That's true. It does make sense.
It does make sense. You know, it might have taken us a long time to get there.
Yeah.
In 2001, there are still people, you know, probably putting, I don't know, hypotheses together and trying to figure out where it went. And for you young folks out there, 2001 is... never mind, I don't want to get there.
Well, had the movie, the first Star Trek movie that they wanted to make, which was The God Thing, or the second one, Planet of the Titans, I think we would have been left with the same sort of, what the hell just happened? So I think we probably lucked out getting the motion picture, at least for sense.
That's right. That's right.
But yeah, no, I'm a huge fan, and I'm thank you so much for the opportunity to come on and just sort of geek out over it, even if there wasn't any kind of linear flow to how our discussion went.
Yeah, it was. You know what? These things are fun, and it gave me an opportunity to get together with somebody I really enjoy speaking with in the first place on a topic that I enjoy speaking about, and you know, and that'll be that. And I promise all the listeners, we will move on to something more fun and exciting and fast paced or whatever it is that. That drive us with our crazy lists and our different things that we've been putting together, and you know those seems to be working well.
A
so
3-part retrospective on And the Children Shall Lead.
Oh my God, no!
Then you'll be begging for the motion picture.
Hey, you know we did a Standard Orbit and a Saturday Morning Trek in with Alternative Factor.
Yes.
Wow. That you know, who would have thought, right? Who would have ever thought? But we did, and
well,
that just
and
talk about boldly
for
going.
Future, yes, exactly. a spoiler for future Saturday Morning Trek. We've talked about, and when our schedules all align, of doing a Mirror Universe animated series. So we're going to have you and Zach on to talk about how that might play out, what that would be like, especially for a Saturday morning audience that would have children. So we have to kind of balance that, you know, level of horrible, terrifying, you know, evil Mirror Universe people with friendly Saturday morning kids show.
That is going to be fun to construct. Of course, yes. if we're looking at a 1970s audience, that was one thing. But today, I don't know. I think it's almost you can go anywhere you want.
In some ways, yeah. In some ways, no. Because if you look at the, you know, if you watch the, there's a plug for anybody who wants to jump over and listen to some of the animated series conversations we've had on Saturday Morning Trek. There are some pretty adult, you know, topics and brought up, and that yeah, I kind of look like, wow, how, you know, how is this? They never wrote it to be a kids show. That was part of it. They wrote it to be sort of an all ages, like anyone can enjoy this.
Yeah, and I guess I wasn't articulating it well. You're absolutely right, and that's what makes the animated series very interesting to go through, is because it's like I'm looking at it saying, geez, I don't remember watching it when I was a kid. I'm sure I did, but I was really little then, you know. Mm-hmm. Even then, I was young once. And And then I guess where I was going was, if you see a lot of the anime or the things that I've been noticing,
right?
It's like, man, it's like there's no filters here. Or
I think there's more gore now and more.
Yeah, it's more suggestive. So
as opposed to, like, story-wise, moralistically, there's a difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that you could probably push it a little bit further, which I think is going to make this a very interesting discussion. Yeah, absolutely. Star Trek The Motion Picture isn't the only thing we are discussing this week on Trek FM. Here is what else is playing on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Saturday Morning Trek.
He's like the little kid from the very last episode of St. Elsewhere. Boba Fett. And all this takes place in the head of Chewbacca's son. The whole panoply of Star Wars. It all takes place in Lumpy's head, all of Star Wars.
I think that we may have cracked the code of Star Wars altogether.
I think we did. Lumpy created Boba Fett.
Warp 5.
They never really do say what sport it is, right? We just assume it's baseball because he said doubleheader.
Well, he went to a baseball game with Hurd, and he said baseball.
I think
game,
he said baseball in Doylestown earlier. So.
Yeah.
Oh, well. All right. Well, sorry, writers. You messed that one up then.
I don't even want to do this commentary anymore. Let's switch it to something else.
Melodic Treks.
Two things to say about that. The first is that Horner was really good at writing sustained cues, always has been. You know, going back to some of his early stuff like Star Trek II, where you have the battle in the Mutara Nebula, you know, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
The 602 Club.
And it's not subtle, but this is what happens. Ego is what happens when you only find meaning in yourself and you are truly all that matters.
And introducing our newest show, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
The key thing with Jetrelli is all of these elements are exactly the same thing as the events in real life. You know, the Metreon Cascade is the bomb. Rhinax is Nagasaki or Hiroshima. You know, the poisoning is analogous to radiation poisoning and all these different things. And the parallels are enormously overt with Jetrell straight away.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows, Phone, and, of course, you can always stream or download the MP3 from our website at Trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for our listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners. Patreon is Trek.fm's way of building funds so that we can support all the podcasts that we broadcast from Trek FM. And there are many, many different shows out there, a huge variety. You name it, if it's Star Trek related, we've got it. And what it takes to run the network, to fund it, to buy equipment, to purchase the bandwidth, the whole thing is very pricey. And yet we do this all commercial free. So we really appreciate you going on to Patreon. That's patreon.com/trekfm and donating whatever you can afford, and no denomination is too much or too little. We'll take it. If you donate $15, you're eligible to participate on Trek FM's Patrons Roundtable, which gets you into podcasting. And then if you donate $25 or more, you could be an associate producer on this show of your choice. So that leads to a very nice spot for us. I'd like to thank, as always, all of our associate producers for Standard Orbit. We have Renee Roberts, Richard Marquez, some guy named Aaron Harvey.
I don't like him.
He's an odd guy. Nick Anastasio, Tim Robertson, Norman Lau, and Corey Elrod. Zach and I are both thrilled to have this wonderful group of people supporting Standard Orbit, and we appreciate you. So, Aaron, where can we find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on pretty much anything that's but social media like Twitter or Dribbble, which is a design community, with the username GeekFilter. And I'm also the network's art director, so you can see my work off and on the Babel Conference, which is our Facebook users group. And I am the host of Saturday Morning Trek. Which is our network's animated series and all things Trek in the 1970s podcast. So you will eventually hear a lot more about the motion picture from us, and But right now we are going to be reviewing Eye of the Beholder.
Excellent.
Which is not the episode from TNG.
Well, I'll say one thing, Aaron. Saturday Morning Trek is probably the most technically advanced, entertaining show I've ever listened to for a podcast. What you're able to pull in from that era, and the way you transition from a commercial to, you know, an interview that was played or whatnot, and it really does feel like you're back in the wood paneled den with lava lamps and beads in the doorways, but it is a great show, and it's a lot of fun. If you haven't checked it out, folks, I highly recommend it, not just because he's here on the screen and I'm looking at him, but because it
with
is...
all the bags under my eyes from producing the show.
It takes an awful lot of work to put that
it
show.
Does.
It's like, it is so... I'll just say this. Check it out. You won't regret it. You'll really enjoy it. You'll have a lot of laughs, but you'll also be brought back to those times back in the 70s and 80s. And I know you have some things that even go back into the 90s. So it's a lot of fun to listen to. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. And so for me, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm there whenever I can get on. And you can find me on Twitter at BostonSCPO. And I just want to say thank you, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.